Is subjectivism in business decision-making still valid in the age of big data and algorithmic analytics? A data scientist tells us that it is. In fact, it's necessary to rescue analytics from its current demise.
This is the Economics for Business podcast. We're here to help all businesses become champions for customers and value, improving lives with preferred and innovative products and services. We offer you the knowledge and tools to make your entrepreneurial journey a successful one. Now, here's your host, Hunter Hastings.
Hi, Hunter Hastings here. We're all for the human touch in business, what we call subjectivism. Loving the customer and developing empathy for them, designing experiences that they'll love, exercising judgment when the facts aren't always decisive, and monitoring feelings and not just numbers. Is that still valid in the age of big data and big analytics and big algorithms and AI? Isn't AI going to rid us of all that qualitative superstition and replace it with emotion-free numbers and data-driven decision-making? Well, data-driven decision-making is not the solution. It's the problem. So says our guest, Ahmed Elsamedizi. And Ahmed knows. He's one of the world's leading AI technologists and data scientists. He has a degree in robotics, and he worked on self-driving cars as well as AI algorithms for the U.S. missile defense systems. He's been a pioneer in Silicon Valley on the cutting edge of commercial applications of AI at WeWork. All of that experience indicated to Ahmed that we're headed in a bad direction in the use of data analytics for business. So he founded Narrator.ai, which is a data analytics platform with a completely new way to build a data model, a new way to query it, and a new form of output that revolutionizes the way businesses use and learn from data. Ahmed's way is all very human. Ahmed, welcome to the Economics of Business podcast.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Well, we're excited too. We're going to talk today about data and data analytics and the stories you can get from data. You're going to tell us all about that. And it coincides with an interesting trend that you and I talked a little bit about off air, which is understanding that the human factor, the human intuition, the way humans interact with data subjectively, human insight is even more necessary in the age of AI and the age of digital analytics. So we look forward to exploring that with you. You're one of the most qualified people in the world, Ahmed, to talk about data and data warehouses and data analytics. So tell us a little bit about your journey before you started your current firm, which is called Narrator.ai. You've been in some wonderful places.
Yeah, so I started my career in like human-robot interaction, thinking about how does a human and a robot make decisions together. Self-driving cars. In 2010, I had a full self-driving car navigating the streets. Then moved into missile defense, which is how do you make decisions in a very high stakes, high actually required, fast moving environment. So if a nuke is hitting the US, how do you discriminate and track and figure out what to do about it? And like my fun fact is like four of the tactical algorithms today, I wrote them. So for the US. Then I moved my way away from like very deep in AI and decision making and into just how do companies make decisions? So how do you leverage data at a fast-moving company where data is changing so quickly? And I'm sure a lot of you have heard of it. It's called WeWork. I joined them, employee number 40, and got to build out the data team and infrastructure there until it became what it is today. And then 5 years ago, I left to start Narrator. So it's been a lot of journey from trying so many different tools in data engineering to trying so many different approaches in AI and machine learning to what I think combines all of that and adds the most important thing, which is the human touch. And that created Narrator. And Narrator came out with this idea from all this past experience. It's always been data first. And data doesn't make decisions or data doesn't take actions. Humans take actions. And the goal of Narrator was, how do we enable people to take action? And it turns out, it's not just data. You don't give someone the answer and they're like, oh, you know what? I'm going to start changing my behavior. So we ended up starting there with the idea of how do we enable actions? And that's what we do today, enable companies to act.
Good. So we're excited about that because we define entrepreneurship in business as action. So anything that we can do to help people act and then figure out what happened afterwards is where we want to be. So one of the things you told me, Ahmed, is that we've made data, we meaning the collective we, the IT community or the data community, and the business intelligence tools we wrap it in, too complex. Now, you could argue that's exactly the point, isn't it? We live in a complex environment, so we need these complex data sets. But what did you mean when you said we're making it too complex?
Yeah. So everyone who's probably listening to this podcast, if you've been on either side of this story, you will resonate with it. You go to your data team or your data or your stakeholder comes to you and they ask seemingly simple questions. Like every time somebody gets our email, how likely are they to come back to our website? Seems simple, right? Everyone can wrap their head around like, that's a normal question. What is the conversion rate? And this question would go to your data team and they'll tell you, give us a month. Now, that's why it's so complicated is because we've separated data. Data is in so many different places. And the process to go from data to that number that the stakeholder wants is quite complicated. Some complexity is needed. Some complexity is baggage and like data debt, so much of tech debt that we've carried. So little history of data. When data was first started, we couldn't store data and we couldn't really process data because our computing power is very low. So we would combine data into big tables and those tables would go into your BI tool to plot because the only way we can explore data was through visualization. Nowadays, we can do a lot more, yet we still abide by this very restrictive process of creating these tabular tables that are designed to plot X and Y by a couple of features. And then we give them to someone and say, hey, you try to find something interesting in this table. And then we give it to an AI and say, AI, try all the combinations and see what sticks out. And like, that's not how decisions are made. And anytime somebody comes in and uses their brain and goes, wait, I have a question that's a little bit more nuanced. We're like, oh, we didn't create the X and Y for you to plot. If that column doesn't exist, let's go back and re-go through the process. So that level of just that, all these kind of hindrances of this rigidness in thinking and asking questions has led to us creating so many tables and so many columns. And now it's like, what does this even mean? And I think all that complexity makes simple questions really hard to answer. And that in itself trains an org to not ask questions.
Yeah, an interesting point you make about building dashboards. So that's what we were very focused on, right, for a long, long time. And you say it's distorted the process. One of the sayings I remember from, I guess it's data analytics or business intelligence, is that once a metric becomes a goal, i.e. people are trying for it, it ceases to be a metric. You've distorted it by turning it into a goal. So maybe that's the problem with dashboards, isn't it?
Well, there's two problems there. So one of them, that's from the book Tyranny of Metrics. They talk about it. Like every single time you set a goal, like people will naturally gain. But that's a problem in analyses, not in the metric. So what happens there, and this is something a narrator actually fights very hard against. So you create a goal, you create a KPI, and what happened is you did an analysis that helped you understand KPI. So let's say you did an analysis that indicates that the time to answer tickets is the biggest indicator for customers' likelihood to have a higher NPS score. Makes sense, right? So that analysis tells you that impact. Now you start saying, okay, we want to optimize a new KPI, which is time to answer ticket. We want that to go down. Because we start gaming the system, what happens is that as people start like hacking and answering super quickly and sloppily, the assumptions of that analysis are now broken. So one of the ways you block it is that every analysis you do with narrator reruns itself every week to check if that assumption is still valid. Because if that assumption changes, then you want to be notified and saying, hey, this metric is no longer good. And that's what happens with our customers when they do like, often you find that time to answer ticket really does impact NPS score. People start gaming it. And then like after a couple of months, it's like not a good metric anymore. So that's one thing that's really important. The second thing that's really important to understand is metrics are for operations, not for understanding. So dashboards are great operationally. You want to know how you're doing every day in time to convert. we've done is we use dashboards as our analysis tool. People are looking at dashboards and slicing and dicing them to try to identify things that matter. And they're asking questions and they're doing it. And dashboards are terrible as analysis tools. I give this quote all the time, which is, if you give 10 people the same dashboard and ask them why is this happening, all 10 of them will come up with 10 different reasons and 10 different stories that all make sense. Because as humans, we are incredible storytellers. And if you give them what a narrator calls a narrative, which is context first, conclusion first, tells you a story of what happened, and it's making the conclusion, guiding you through the actual decision-making, all 10 of them will come to the same conclusion. And that's because narratives and stories is how you should think about debugging, is how you should think about analysis, how you should think about root cause. Dashboards are operationally. And right now, these BI companies have convinced you that you can use a dashboard for analyses, for stories, for everything. And now we lead to a lot of confusion.
So before we get to stories, Ahmed, you say at Narrator that we don't need all these tables that you're talking about. We need one time series with three variables, customer activity and time. So explain that to us. That sounds rather radical.
Yeah. So good old-fashioned radical ideas. So the biggest innovation that Narrator had after years of looking is that we found that data teams, me included, built a lot of tables. And every table had two things happening in each table. One, it was defining the building blocks and with lots of complex querying. It was joining the data with lots of complex querying. And it was what a table was representing was a series of questions that it was trying to answer. That's how you put that table. You can slice and dice it and answer, let's say, 10 questions. So whenever you restrict yourself into those 10 dimensions, there's only about 10, maybe 50 questions you can possibly answer with this table. And inevitably, somebody's going to come up with another question. So what we were thinking about, which is how do we represent data so that we can build something that applies data definitions but can answer all the questions? Because if every time you have a new question, you have to wait weeks for your data team to build a new table, you're never gonna get to action because usually you go through like five or six questions before making it an action. And if each one takes a month, like you're just gonna act without data. So we spent a lot of time thinking about what is this idea of a universal data model? What is a data model that can answer any question? And what we realized is as humans, we have this data model that can answer any questions. And it's language. We use words and we have to figure out a way to describe every question you ever have. You describe it in English. And it turns out almost any data question can be described as a core entity, which we call a customer, doing some action in time. Let's take the example I gave earlier, that email to order. You can say every time somebody opens an email, I want to know if they order before they open another email. That's it. I want to know the rate of the order at. Seems simple. I'm describing it as actions, opened email and had an order as a person, the customer, in time. And it turns out every question can be broken down to the structure. So if we represent data into the structure, we're able to use the structure to answer every question in the world. And what you're thinking, this sounds very obvious. Why hasn't everyone done this? Like this is like, there's no time, customer, and action. It's like event tables. We've seen this many times. And it turns out the reason why this is a lot of people before us had come up with this idea of like, hey, this is a great unit model. All of AI, if you know the field of Bayesian mathematics of like half of what is used AIs and cars and decision making, all of that is just the entity, time, and action. That's how most AI is done. So we know that it can do everything. Why doesn't it work in data? And the answer is SQL doesn't work that way. You can't query this table. It's really hard to do that in SQL.
When you say SQL, you mean the database, the software specifically.
Yeah, the databases. So databases speak in a language that is like, at its core, imagine a VLOOKUP. They're all like, all databases speak in this idea of VLOOKUP. And if you have like a single table, you can't really VLOOKUP with conditions above it. You can't really do this time-based language. When I say words like in between and first, databases don't do that. So what we had to do was we had to build a layer that allows us to ask questions using those words and then convert that into something that a database can understand and then give us the answer. And that's what took 3 years of like research and development at Narrator to make possible. And then everything else became like seamless, because then any question you ask can be just used in this terminology, and it works. And it works when you have 100 billion rows. It works when you have 1 trillion rows. It works when you're a small company. It works when you're asking one question or 10 questions. And it works for all different business models, whether you're company to company, or like we have crypto companies, we have real estate, we have hospitals, we have banks, and it's just anything you can, coding companies, insurance, all sorts of companies have turned out that they can all be using the same data model, which is customer time and action, and they can answer any question they have, and it all happens seamlessly.
Yeah, it's brilliant.
A quick note. Economics for Business is a uniquely Austrian platform to help entrepreneurs build value-generating businesses at every stage of the entrepreneurial journey. We've now launched online with an outstanding database of entrepreneurial knowledge, tools to solve specific business problems, and a community exchange to share information and experiences. Check it out at econ4business.com. That's econ4business.com. Explore and let us know what works best for you in the feedback section. Now, back to our conversation.
And then you say, then you interact differently with the data. You say the next breakthrough is to have a conversation with the data, asking the right question in the right way. Tell us more about that. I mean, what does a conversation with the data feel like?
Yeah, so this is something that our customers are always talking about. They say that it's a cultural shift. So today, let's say without Narrator, you kind of have this weird, long-winded way of talking to your data. It's like you kind of play telephone with the data. So you see a dashboard, it gives you a question. You're like, ooh, okay. Then you tell your person who goes and asks the data person, who then goes to the data analyst. Data analyst takes that question, formulates it a little bit, gives it to data engineer. Data engineer takes that question, formulates it a little bit, writes a SQL query to model, which goes back to data, which gets reviewed, and then goes back to data analyst, and then it goes to the BI engineer. The BI engineer builds a dashboard thinking they answer the question, and then you get a new dashboard that kind of answers. And it's been so long that you lost your train of thought. It's been like a game of telephone that's like been played with like post mail. So every single layer is taking weeks. And then you get this like answer a month, 2 months later, that's like not really what you wanted, but maybe you look at it and then you're like, wait. And then you ask a little different question, and then it goes back to a process. And by then you've already made your decision. So this is what we currently have. Talking to data should feel a little bit like you're asking a question. You instantly are able to see an answer. You're able to get data to talk to you back through stories. It generates a story. It try to helps you understand and interpret the data. It aggregates it. It gives you examples. It helps build your intuition. And it returns this analysis for you right away with the data, guiding you through what you're trying to do. And then you're like, wait, that's not kind of what I want. I want to ask another question. And then you go in and you update the question, or you go, that's interesting. Who the hell did that? You're able to kind of dive and go and do this thing in a session. So in like 30 minutes, I've answered 3 or 4 questions and I dive into it. One of the case studies we recently published was a dating app, and their data analyst was telling us this experience of talking to data. And she says, yeah, I started with one question that our business stakeholder had, and it ended up becoming 30 separate analyses that I ran in the same day. And then I got this metric that was the thing that we found was the most important. And now the entire company is aligned on moving that metric. And I'm sure that if the assumption changes, Narrator will let me know. But that's a conversation. She started with one and she was doing it by herself, interacting with the data, left and right, getting an answer, updating her brain, because her brain is the magical intuition that understands the context. And then her brain gets all this new information in a way that it can digest in a story. It automatically updates its intuition, and then it refines its question and it goes in. And that's what happens when you're having a conversation with data. And I think time and ease of responding back to you with information that is text-based, that is story-based, is how you get that feeling of a conversation and less of a, like, honestly, there's like this it's like, it feels sometimes like it's like a joke, like Pictionary, like somebody says something and you get back a picture and you're like, that's kind of what I was looking for. And now we've changed that. And it's now like this natural conversation you have. And the results have been incredible. People end up, we don't judge ourselves by a little side note. A lot of BI tools love putting in like 3,000 dashboards built, like 70 billion rows processed. And you're like, so what? Like, what are you doing? And we like to, we allow people to log their actions and start creating their, like what they did. And that's what Narrator calls success, is that it's not about that we gave you data. It's not about you did 30 analysis. That's cool. That's the conversation. That's not the output. We look at the end of the day, what actions did you take? And what we found was that the more, because Narrator evolved over years, but because of the stories, people were able to like actually take actions. People print. Like our most common feature on narratives isn't the share, but it's the print. Like people literally print out these analyses and these and download these PDFs and send them out to their team to be like, here's what I found. Like this is, it feels like sharing. And honestly, that's what we used to do for years and years and years and years. And it worked really well. Like think about all the major decisions made. Somebody got an analysis that they read and they're like, let's do this. I want to see the same way that this happened with the BI tool. If someone looked at a dashboard and was like, oh, I'm inspired. Like, and yeah. Then just decided it just doesn't work that way. So I think that's kind of what I mean by that conversation.
And that's lovely. I have a great picture of that. I visited your blog on Narrator, and you're trying to help people to have better conversations, but it kind of implies it's not so easy, that it's hard to ask the right questions in the right way. But you can help people do that, yeah?
Yeah. So when you think about kind of like the skill sets that we've been teaching the world, asking questions is not a skill set that we've taught. Data analysis, like 50 years ago, used to be like a lot. It used to feel like consulting. It used to be about asking the right question. Nowadays, we've taken this data analyst role and killed it and replaced it with lots of code that doesn't do it. We're trying to replace intelligence, human intelligence, with AI. We're trying to build more tables. We're trying to build more dashboards. We're trying to do all these things. And it has made SQL a required skill set. It's made like coding and all these things. And what skills that we've kind of thrown away has been asking questions. And we see this all the time. Like every now and then we'll be talking to customers and we spend a lot of time in Narrator. We talk about it as one of the most important things in our education and the culture we want to change, which is how do I get someone to ask the right question? Here's an example. We're working with a company that does videos, and they said this. They had this exact question. They were like, based on when we launch, we have videos they launch. I want to know how likely someone is to like sign up for the video based on what time we launched the video. Okay. Does that sound like a good question or a bad question? It sounds pretty good, right? It makes sense.
Yeah, it sounds like a question one might ask.
Yeah, but like it's impossible, right? Like what you're asking doesn't make any actual sense if you think about it more nuancedly. In the first glance, you'll be like, oh, that's a great question, and we start answering it. And then you will do an analysis and it'll be wrong and you'll make a decision and you'll go down this path. And like I've seen companies go all the way down to taking actions and they're like, I wonder why that action didn't work. And here's the problem. When you launch a class, has no impact on when the customer signs up because the customer doesn't know when you launched it. For example, if I launch it at 4 a.m. and then I send an email and everyone gets alerted about it at 8 a.m., is it 8 a.m. that matters or the 4 a.m. when I launched it?
Yeah.
This is a critical point.
Yeah.
So the question you're trying to ask is when it's based on the time the customer first ever sees a class, how likely are they to convert? You have to have it from the customer's perspective. That difference is some customers, different time zones might come in and view it in the beginning of the day. Sometimes customers get it when you send an email, and that's when most people come and view it. It's not when your code said, yes, turn this video on the website, because people are not refreshing the website every second. And then as soon as you launch it, everyone sees it. People see it distributed over days. So the question is about from the customer's perspective. That small difference in question makes this question, one, a lot harder to answer, so that most people don't even bother doing it because they'd rather do the easier one. But that one leads to action. because you can realize what drives people. Like, you're like, you'll be surprised. Oh, we launch it at 4 a.m., but everyone sees it at 9. And 9 a.m. is when people see it and then convert. Like, that's what you want to understand. So it sounds like a good question, but people have been trained. And what we've done in Narrator is we've put in everything we've done in Narrator has been to move people toward the right question. People will try to do that first question, and Narrator will be like, that's an impossible question. And they'll be like, why? And then they eventually realize that there's no common identity, or the person, the computer launches it, but the person hasn't seen it. So you can't tie what the computer is doing to what the person is doing. You have to tie what the person is experiencing to what the person is doing. And Narrator forces that. And then we slowly guide you through all these other things that we do to help you understand how that is would work and impact it. So that's kind of the shift that you have. And that's a seemingly small example. And this is, I can give hundreds of cases that we have thought about a Narrator in building our tool that kind of nudges people toward the right decision versus the wrong decision. And we see so many. Like, I wish you, I can give you like the top 10 most common mistake questions people ask. And what you will see is every single question, you'll be like, oh, everyone has asked that question. That makes sense. And you're like, think about it. Like, and then once you go through it, they're like, oh yeah, that doesn't make sense. And that's the nature, because everyone has just kind of gotten to this cliche of these basic wrong questions asked. Because the reason is because dashboards make it way easier to show you based on what time the class launched, how many signups had it. That's an easy thing to build in a dashboarding tool. Based on when a customer first viewed it, how likely are they to do it? Way harder doing a dashboarding tool. And instead of building tools that help us ask, answer better questions, we've let dumb tools make our questions dumb.
So for my own mental model, or mental model of anyone who's listening, does that sequence of customer action time always apply? So I can frame my question, who's the customer, and do I know exactly who the customer is? What are they doing, and how do I relate that to a time series? Is that a good, at least, basic framework to use?
Yeah. I think whenever customer is a word that sometimes confuses people, but think about it as like the entity that you're trying to impact. Every question can be phrased as an entity you're trying to impact. It has to be one. You can't impact two entities at the same time. It's always one entity. And something is happening to them, or something, they're doing something, but it's from their perspective. And you're either trying to change what they're doing or what's happening to them. So in time. So every question can be phrased that way. And I urge people, if you have a question that you don't think can be phrased that way, send me an email and I will show you how we can phrase it that way. I've been doing this for years now, so I love questions that can be phrased that way. And if you believe that every question can be phrased that way, then you can have a conversation with Narrator and ask and answer those questions instantly.
And again, from your blog, I think I got it. You say that the errors that we make, the bad questions, you call them lazy hypothesis generation. And that's what we've got to overcome. We call it think better. That's one of our mantras. You're helping people to think better. Is that accurate?
Yeah. So lazy hypothesis. Here's an indicator of someone who I think we always say when someone's like, oh, well, why don't we look at everything and see what matters? That's a lazy hypothesis. You're just like shooting. And honestly, companies, a lot of AI companies have made their entire business on, we'll test everything for you. And then you end up getting junk. And they're $1 billion companies. We're not talking about small companies. They're $1 billion. Dashboarding companies are like, we'll let you slice by anything. $1 billion, hundreds of billions of dollars is spent in people not thinking and thinking, oh, this is being data driven. That's not being data driven. That's splunking. That's just garbage. That's thinking lazy. And thinking better to me is think about what you can change. Think about how it affects the entity you're trying to change and ask a question. And it feels slower, but what happens is that you're thinking, instead of the computer just junking and trying a billion things that don't make any sense, you're doing that up here. And then you're asking the ones that actually you can do something with. And that's how we say, like, computers should never ask questions. Computers are designed to help you evaluate an analysis. Let the human do the 1,000 combinations of what you think actually could matter. And then you formulate questions that are so good that a lot of times computers can't think of. And then that's what we want to do. And if you can't formulate good questions, then you're thinking badly. And I think that thinking lazy is like the virus that has impacted. And it's been honestly, as a as a person who buys data tools, and like, it's, I blame tools. I blame companies. They've kept, like, they say that, like, you know, a famous comedy stand-up says, like, the best shows when you have a drunk audience, because they're like not thinking through everything, so that everything is just easier. I feel like that's like a lot of these companies. They go, the best customer is one who's not thinking too much, and they sell you this like thing that always sounds incredible, and you're like, what? Does this actually work? And I think that's the point that I'm always like, I hate that stuff. It's just a lot of bullshit. Like, we are really good at like telling you, oh yeah, wouldn't it be cool if we can analyze every single factor and tell you what matters?
Yep.
Yeah, sure. But like,
I think that's right.
Like, I did, when we did that, we used one of the largest company's product that way. And it like spits out junk. I've never seen it spit out anything good. And then people really take advantage of your lack of knowledge, because they'll tell you like, oh, this is like advanced AI. And you're like, Amazon has like 100,000 engineers, and like their stupid Alexa can't understand, turn off all the lights. It'll be like, sorry, there's no room called all. And you're telling me that your AI has figured out like my complex business, like in my 20 years of doing this business with my past experience, you're going to ask a better question than me? No. But, and you, executives and people, you have a million questions you want answered. If you can get those questions answered, you'd be making 100x better decisions. Why are you leaving a computer to ask the questions that you already know and answer them? Like, they're bad at it and they can't really evaluate it. Instead, invest in your ability to ask and answer questions. So by you receiving the answer, you're not only getting a, like, whether it matters or not, but you're getting, you're learning as you're looking at the data. And you're refining a million questions in your head, and you're building better intuition. And like, you're investing in your team to make better decisions and better questions. And that's the thing that matters. And I'm going to keep saying this until like I grow old and die, just like, invest in the people making better decisions.
Yeah.
And they're like, no, no, we're investing in the tools so we can answer questions. No, no. Like, if a tool can't give you answers in like minutes, like, and you have to set it up and you have to tell it what questions you need a month in advance, like, that's not helpful. You need to be able to have a conversation. You need to think. You need to do the work. And there's stuff that you have to do. You can't just outsource all your thinking.
Can we blame education a little bit, Ahmed? I've heard it said that in schools and universities and colleges, we're not teaching young people to be questioning like that, to be skeptical of data. We're teaching them the mechanics of how you generate the data outputs and the tools, as you call them, but we're not teaching them to think like you say they think. Is that part of the problem? We're not teaching it to the kids?
So yes and no. So I think about like, so when I studied AI, it was all about decision-making. We spent all our time in understanding how humans combine information, how probabilities work, how decisions are made. You don't, like when you're building an autonomous car, you're not like, you decide what to do. You no, no, you put a lot of constraints and you're like optimizing for a function, and you're like, if the you should have an idea of why the computer is making the decision it's making. Then rose this idea of big data. And big data initially started as a movement of making big decisions with data, and it became about data size. And then a lot of these computing companies were like, oh, let's just put all the data in and spit out something. Let's use neural networks. Those tech tools were used for like images and like understanding stuff in images, which is hard to reason about. And we started shoving them everywhere that anything works. And then it created this demand in these companies for data scientists and machine learning. And everyone wanted to just like, oh, let's, why don't we just apply machine learning and have computers work? So we shifted the requirement from people's skill set to be understanding algorithms to implementing algorithms. And that shift created, because schools teach you whatever people are getting hired for. So then I see a lot of people coming out of boot camps, coming out of schools, who know how to implement 100 algorithms, but have no idea what any of them like actually mean. Like, I do this. Here's an example of education failing. I interview so many AI engineers and so many data scientists, and senior, junior, and I always ask them the same question. I say, do you understand how a best fit line works? And everyone's like, yeah, duh. Best fit line is the first thing I learned. It's like easy. And I'm like, cool, what does it do? And it's like, it minimizes the error. And I'm like, but how? And they're like, oh, it just minimized the error. And I'm like, great, okay, great. Here's the rule. I want you to give me, take the data and give me a best fit line where no error is negative. 95% of data scientists and machine learning engineers, crap. Because they've been so used to, like, I apply this algorithm to this, take data. I don't know how to evaluate what it means. I just take data. I create 100 columns. I shove it in an algorithm. And then I get output. And I try to optimize for an ROC curve. And I overfit the data until the ROC curve looks good. And then it goes to, it deploys to production. And it never works. And you're like, why doesn't it work? Or it gets shelved. So that's what we're teaching people how to do. We teach so many ROC. I've seen these courses. I've given talks in schools and I'm like, stop optimizing for this curve. Like, it doesn't matter. Like, why are we doing this? Like, doesn't matter. I give an example of predicting. I talked to a lot of executives and I always ask them this question. I'm like, they're like, can you do predictive? Are you able to predict future sales? And I'm like, cool. Why doesn't your conversion rate do that? Number of leads times conversion rate to closing should equal number of sales. Okay. And they're like, hey, no, but like we have to do a multilinear combination analysis. And I'm like, why doesn't your conversion rate work? Well, there's all these factors that play a role because people's tenure and industry and da da da. Well, first answer the question, why does the conversion rate work? Like, because it looks like it works. If your conversion rate is stable, it works. Most conversion rates are stable. You're not every month, you're not converting 90% and then 10% and then 90% and then 30. It's not random. If your conversion rate was random, your business is broken. Conversion rates are relatively stable. Now, why are you unable to predict it? And then you start seeing that people don't know how to compute a conversion rate. They're like, oh, take all the data and let's give you my conversion rate. And I'm like, what? Well, hasn't your business changed? You've gotten better or worse? Data is not equal. Okay, let's take the last 60 days. Why 60? Why not 90? Why not 82? Okay, let's take the last 60 because it's a good amount. How long take people to convert? All these questions. They go, it takes 30 days for people to convert. So let's take between 90 and 30 days. Has that 30 days changed? Oh yeah, we've gotten faster. Okay, well, computing a conversion rate is tricky. But once you compute a good conversion rate, prediction works. You don't need neural networks and deep learning and like a computer that can play Go to like help you answer how many sales you're going to get. You just need a good quality conversion rate. And we know that's possible because talk to an executive who's been in the industry for more than 30 years. They built billion-dollar companies just using those numbers and multiplying them in their heads. They didn't need neural networks to do it. Like, it didn't need that. But now it's shiny, and we have let shininess distract us from thinking. And like you said, you say, think better. But like, I think we talked about this earlier too, which was, you know, this field called economics has existed for years, and we have used it to predict a lot of things. And no economic paper has ever said, I used a neural network to make decision, because no one, it's just garbage. Yeah. Like, it's thinking properly and systematically to make quality decisions through stories. And you read the economic papers, and economic paper is never a dashboard. You don't get an economics dashboard. You get a paper that's giving you plots with text and telling you a story, and you read it and you can predict how like countries are behaving. You're telling me that your business is more complicated than a country, and that's why you replace the story and data and reasoning and quality thinking with dashboards, AIs that play games that now can give you random fun facts, and like $1 billion of tool investment in this like a trillion row data set. Like, economics has operated with not a trillion rows of data. You don't need quapepabytes of data. You need quality data, thinking, and stories. And we've kind of taken that way that used to work so well and replaced it with this junk. And the problem is that first way, it's all about good hiring and good people and thinking. This other way, lots of companies make a lot of money on this way. Lots of companies make a lot of money on this other way. And you see the marketing, and marketing works. Marketing works. And we've convinced the world of it.
So let's talk about stories a little bit more. You've touched on it a few times, Ahmed, but you say the output of Narrator is stories. And we're beginning to find in the digital age and the agile world and so on that the power of narrative and storytelling is tremendous. We're just beginning to appreciate it anew, perhaps, that it's what binds people together. It puts shared understanding. It's shared values. If you get the narrative right, you can get everybody in the company going in the right direction. Tell us a little bit about how you think about storytelling as the output and how it brings the teams together and helps them go forward.
Well, we call our analyses and our like kind of the way we present data, we call them narratives for the exact purpose. Narratives are, in my mind, the tool to align people. Narratives has to do, and we think of narratives as they have to do a bunch of things. There's two kinds of narratives, one that we call like a story and one that we call an analysis. One of them is taking a question, giving you an action and a recommendation, giving you takeaways up front. So you kind of build that intuition of what you're going to learn. And then through English, where it gives you conclusion first, gives you text explaining what you're going to do, and using plots and visualizations as supporting evidence to get you to understand. And it's in sections, it gives you conclusions, and its goal is to educate you into do the work that you can believe of in the analysis, and you can communicate the output of the analysis and all the stuff that it did to someone else, so you can align people on why this analysis makes sense. So that's the first part. We call them analyses. Then there's stories. Stories are, again, designed to align people. We've seen customers use our narratives for product specs. We've seen them use them for, we use the internal narrator, our investor updates, our board decks, our customer success dashboards. Everything we do is in a narrative. And what that allows us to do is not just show data and just throw it, but interpret the data and put it into a format where it's trying to help you understand. Even something as simple as putting the question and the context of what you're asking and then interpreting the data for you and giving you the conclusion of what you should get out of the plot and not leaving everything up to interpretation, you get this consistency. And it's like what I said earlier. We see this thing. You send a narrative to 100 people in your company, everyone understands the same thing. That doesn't happen with dashboards. Send a dashboard to 10 people, they're going to get 10 different things. And that alignment allows you to do a lot of things. It's not, again, the alignment is what gets you to execute properly. It gets you to act, question. It gets everyone to move in the general right direction. And I think that's the key. It's kind of like the planning and the getting the knowledge that people have an execution strategy. Notice here, everything I said about narratives, data is such a small part of them. Data is like the supporting evidence. It's what gives people confidence and helps people understand where the conclusions came from as it. And we've used narratives and stories for all the time. McKinsey, every consulting company's entire business model is stories. It's narratives. They help you write the narrative. And what we have now enabled is what we're seeing and seeing it is that you can give these narratives. Companies can write their own narratives. You can use some of our narratives. And we're actually about to open up, hopefully early next year, our store. Because remember, the single table is a standard. When you have a standard, you can actually reuse narratives and templatize them. And we can get narratives. There's not a million ways to understand what attribution model you should use. There is a way of thinking about it and deciding it and how do you reason about it. And we write a blog on it, people understand it. And we have a narrative that explains to you which attribution model you should use. And you should read it and understand it and be convinced. And rate us on it. Like, we're going to allow you to rate and say, this narrative actually did convince me, or this is bullshit. Like, and I think that's the world, is you align people on these stories. And I think it needs to be easy to create stories. It needs to be easy to share stories. It needs to be easy to integrate with data. It needs to be able to adjust. One of the things that happens in today's age, narratives are stories. One of the reasons why people don't like them is that they go stale. Until this moment, I interpreted the data when I did the analysis. But now, next month, well, data has changed. Should I interpret the same way? Like, that's why people often avoid and just use dashboards, because it's more live data. What narrative enables you is to codify a little bit of your thinking and your decision making and use some of our tools to help you do that, so that as the data change, your interpretation can change and the narrative can actually react and adjust and tell a different story as data is changing, and can really help you make that decision. And that's why it's something that lives on into your system as a wealth of knowledge. And all good questions and all good narratives, I'm sure every company, every book I read, the CEOs will say about like the analysis that changed their business and these things. Now, I bet that analysis that changed your business, probably 100 people asked it in the past, and it just went into some drawer. But with Narrator, all those analyses and every question that everyone asks stays there, is constantly being evaluated. And now you have a story that when it's important, it'll get lifted up and you can read it and understand it. And it is aligning people to act.
Yep. It's a wonderful product. I want to test a terminology that we're experimenting with that tries to capture this idea of the combination of human feel and intuition and story with data and numbers. We call it subjective quantification. And where we get that from is consumers. So consumers look at some value proposition and they evaluate it in a kind of qualitative fashion. Yes or no, should I buy that? And then maybe they compare it with something else in a qualitative fashion. Do I like the green one or the red one or whatever that might be? But they have this brilliant moment where they turn it into a number, which is a price. They'll pay something for it. So they brilliantly mm-hmm. and seamlessly go from qualitative to quantitative, and they can do that. And so that seems to us like support for this idea of subjectivism plus data and quantification. So what do you think of our term?
Yeah, I like it. I think it's subjective quantification has a test of that there's an opinion, there's a human aspect to it. It's quantitative, you're still doing it. The one thing that I want to add a word to it, but I don't know what the right word is, because I think there's a point in doing. So I think as a standalone one dimension, yes. But like everything I talk about in life is that time is a factor. So there's a value as you add layers and you do this many, many times, there becomes this level of intuition. So a goal of mine is like you. Like some, it's like you're building intuition via subjective quantification. Like there's something that has to happen that is growing in time. And what's growing and changing by doing a lot of subjective quantification is literally like either your intuition or your learning or your growth or your, like, cause it gets better. Think about subjective quantification is like, you can argue about it, you can change it, but it's always, something's always getting better. And I think that's the key thing here is that people often like to think about like, it's by doing this, there is value also in time and of you.
No, that's a great addition. We sometimes talk about that as getting a feel for your business, which is that intuition that you're talking about.
Yeah.
Well, Ahmed, thank you very much for today. We've learned a ton. We'll send people to your website, the narrator.ai, and I'll send them specifically to the blog because I found that tremendously helpful. Some of it you wrote and some of your colleagues wrote. But is there anywhere else you'd like people to find Narrator?
Those two places are great. I'm also active on LinkedIn. If you're interested in following me on LinkedIn, I share a lot of similar opinions. And yeah, feel free to reach out. Like I think message me if you have any questions, you want to challenge it, do it. Like all these things, I'm here to spread the word. And I think the more people that are talking about these things, subjective quantification, getting a feel, thinking better, everything that economic business stands for, I think the better the world will be. So let's all work together to move the world in that direction.
Amen. Thank you very much, Ahmed.
Economics for Business is a production of the Mises Institute. To explore more content like this, visit econforbusiness.com. And for more from Hunter Hastings, visit hunterhastings.com.